morning. Welcome to CSIS. Thank you all for being here this morning. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS, and we're thrilled this morning to be able to be joined by Dr. Margaret Hamburg, Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, who's kindly agreed to come here and have an extended conversation this morning with us around the transformation underway at FDA into a global public health safety agency. Just a few words of introduction, and then we'll turn to our conversation. We handed out one flyer for an event that's happening here in a little over 2 weeks, which is Sir Richard Feachem will be here on the 17th of October, which is a Wednesday, 3 to 5 p.m., talking about malaria, which should be quite an interesting presentation. He, former head of the Global Fund, senior official at the World Bank on health, and now at UCSF, has been doing work on global malaria control eradication for quite some time. So he'll be here from 3 to 5 p.m. that day. What we're going to do this morning, we're going to have a structured conversation for the first part of our time here, and then we will open the floor after 30 or 40 minutes of discussion. We'll open the floor and welcome all of you to come forward with brief comments and questions, and there'll be folks in the rear carrying microphones to you. I want to offer special thanks to a number of people who worked very hard over the last few months to try and find a good, convenient time at which Dr. Hamburg could be here with us. From FDA, Karen Riley, Kay Springer, were very, very helpful, and we're very grateful to each of them for their assistance. In Beijing, we had the chance to meet with the FDA country director a week before last, Chris Hickey, and the HHS health attaché in Beijing, Liz Yuan, both of whom were very passionate, very informed, and very generous in their insights as to this experience of FDA's largest set of operations outside of our borders in China, moving at a very rapid pace. I also want to thank from CSIS my many colleagues who worked very hard on this, Alicia Kramer, Lindsay Hammergren, Julia Noggle, Carolyn Schroep, Don Morton, some newcomers, Giselle Bailo and Shana McAvee. Thank you all for helping us. So let's get started. Our purpose here today, we've had the opportunity in the past. Dr. Hamburg kindly came here early in your tenure as commissioner, shortly after coming on board in May of 2009. We had a gathering to talk about the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, and we talked about NCDs, and that was very useful, and it was tied together with some actions that were happening in Congress. Dr. Hamburg comes to this position at FDA having served in very senior positions as a senior scientist at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, as an assistant secretary at HHS for policy during the Clinton administration, as the commissioner for health in New York City, as a young research scientist at two of the NIH institutes. Has come to the FDA job at a remarkable time with a remarkable background, and it's been an extremely busy period. And so we thought this was a great moment as we head into the last part of this year and into the close of the first Obama administration to ask you really to share with us your reflections with a special focus on globalization and the transformations that are underway, but also to share with us more broadly other things that have really struck you as the most signature aspects of this period. Now, why don't we just start and explain to us what is it when you think about the changes that are underway in FDA and the way in which its global agenda is coming to the fore in such a powerful and strong way? What are the major driving forces that account for that? And looking forward, what is that likely to be?
Well, I think the major reality is that we live in a globalized world, and we are looking at the regulation of products that, in fact, are coming in whole or in part from sources all around the world, and it really does change our focus and our agenda. We regulate, as you probably know, a very wide range of products. We're responsible for the safety and efficacy of drugs, medical devices, vaccines and biologics, both animal drugs and veterinary drugs, I might add, the safety of the nation's food supply for the most part, the blood supply, the safety of cosmetics and dietary supplements, products that emit radiation, and most recently, tobacco products. So it's a very wide array of products, actually products that account for almost 25 cents of every dollar that consumers in this country spend on products and, you know, things that really matter to people and make a difference in their lives. And when we look at the breakdown of those products, you know, we have to recognize that our responsibilities extend far beyond our shores. On the drug side, 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients used in drugs that we take here are actually manufactured in other countries. And about 40% of the drugs that we take are made in other countries. Devices somewhere in the same range. On the food side, the numbers are equally impressive. It's estimated that about 85% of seafood that we eat comes from beyond our borders, 50% of fresh fruit and nuts, somewhat less in terms of vegetables, but still a substantial number, about 20%. So these are powerful drivers in terms of our responsibility to think globally, and really requires changing our model for our regulatory and public health role as well.
So describe for us, just over the last 3.5 years, what are the most important changes that have happened here with respect to congressional authorities, legislation, dialogue with, internally, and restructuring within FDA, because you've had some of that, some important changes there. The pieces that reflect this transformation that's happening. You've had 2 or 3 major studies by affiliated and independent organizations. Just to try and fill in, like, okay, that in this last 40 months or so, how has that looked?
Yeah. Well, this has been a trend that, of course, has been going on for quite a while, but it's accelerated significantly in the last decade in terms of absolute numbers. The number of FDA-regulated products that are imported has quadrupled in the last decade, and one does notice that. In addition, there certainly have been some real-world wake-up calls prior to my tenure at the FDA, but very significant was, of course, the episode involving contaminated heparin, a blood-thinning drug that is very, very important in the medical management of many patients here and around the world. And there was adulteration of heparin, which caused severe allergic reactions in many patients and seemed to be linked to a number of deaths. And it certainly galvanized FDA into action, both to identify what was the cause of this unexpected adverse reaction associated with heparin, to develop a screening test to be able to protect against this problem going forward, but also to think about what does this really mean in terms of how we think about supply chain integrity and safety, and how do we think about other risks that exist in the marketplace. So I think that, combined with a few other international episodes, melamine in dairy products and pet food, you may or may not remember, ethylene glycol in cough syrup, not in this country, but killing kids in South America or Central America, a number of you know, fairly visible episodes of adulteration of products that suggested that we really had to be paying increasing attention to these complex supply chains that are involved in the products that that come here that we're responsible for overseeing, and that the American people want to be able to have confidence in. And so, you know, I think that as we started to look at this set of issues, FDA had begun to think more globally and had begun to create some offices, some presence in some critical countries. You mentioned China being one, India, and with our European colleagues and a few other places early on. But I think it was really just in the last couple years where we've really sort of sat down, brought in outside experts to help us think through some of the challenges as well, and really developed a whole new strategy where we no longer view ourselves or describe ourselves as a domestic agency. We believe that we have to be a global agency with a global mission and with partnerships within government and industry and with the scientific community that are global as well.
You've put out a couple of statements around the pathway forward and laying down what some of the priorities will be for FDA, the four different top things that will drive you forward. Can you just talk about that?
Well, you know, as we have thought about both restructuring internally to be a more integrated program, domestic and international, and what is really required to address in a meaningful way, in a sustainable way, the growing volume of product manufacturers, processors, distributors, repackagers, exporters, importers that are all part of this supply chain that we are committed to providing oversight of, that this was not a problem that we were ever going to be able to take the sort of historical FDA approach to address, which is inspections either at the border as products come in. You know, in the early days of the FDA, the ship would come into port and we'd, you know, have them roll the molasses barrels off and we'd look in and say, yes, it's good to go, and that would be that. Well, when you're getting 24 million import lines a year coming in to over 300 ports of entry, you know, that is not a viable strategy. And realizing we could never send enough FDA inspectors overseas to go to all the manufacturing sites that also are bringing products in, over 300,000 now in more than 150 countries, we had to have some new models. And so this new approach really is organized around a set of important principles. One is really moving towards creating a global coalition of regulators, mm-hmm. really a new global governance mm-hmm. model that enables us to work together in a much more coordinated way, since we share common goals of trying to protect the product supplies that we're responsible mm-hmm. for regulating in our own countries in a world where it also involves both how regulatory oversight happens in other countries and also these product pathways. So really forming new coalitions and new ways of working together. For that to be effective, we also need new data systems and means for sharing information, because mm-hmm. the critical thing is everyone is facing the problem of dramatically increased demands and, sadly, already limited human and dollar resources, but probably constricting in the real world that we live in. So we need to figure out ways to share information and effectively share workload. We also need to be much more strategic in how we address the challenges before us. And we really need a risk-based approach. We need to be able to use the best science, the best experience and expertise to target the highest risk products and to use our resources in ways that will make the greatest difference, really identifying and addressing the critical vulnerabilities in a product supply chain or addressing the the commodities that are intrinsically highest risk, or understanding a broader context that may put a particular product at risk at a given time, but really targeting resources through risk-based analyses and bringing new technologies to bear, including information technologies, mm-hmm. which actually have greatly enhanced our capabilities. I think I was here one time and talked about the initiation of a new program, the PREDICT model, that does risk-based, data-driven, computer-guided targeting for border identification. And then we really also need to come together and find new partnerships if we're going to, not just with our regulatory counterparts, which is critically important, but with all stakeholders who are involved in this global challenge, importantly including industry, because many of the industries that we regulate are, of course, multinational, but all industries that are producing products that are entering into global commerce have a stake in really helping to improve the quality and integrity of products. It ultimately benefits everyone. And frankly, I also believe that we need to integrate this thinking about regulatory capacity and the role of product safety into other investments that we as a nation and other nations are making in terms of how we're spending development dollars and how we're mm-hmm. using strategic diplomatic resources as well.
This change that you've described, it seems like it has not been particularly controversial or turbulent here in the United States in the dialogue with Congress and the like. I mean, that your funding for your overseas operations is going up. You've had the 5-year renewal of your user fee legislation, the Fiducia, which includes some new authorities. Mm-hmm. In January of 2011, the modernizing FDA came forward. I mean, can you say a few words about why is it that there seems to be a relative consensus
yeah.
across different constituencies and political outlooks in favor of this transformation?
Yeah. Well, I think it has taken some time, and we're going through different iterations. I mean, frankly, when I first started talking about some of these issues after I became FDA commissioner on the Hill and in other settings, people did look puzzled. They yeah. really didn't quite get it. And do you really need to be investing resources overseas? And isn't this a good time to be investing in America? Would be another comment, often coming from members of Congress. And, you know, do we really want these Chinese products anyway? But, you know, I think when you sit down and start talking about the realities, and we're not going back from the world that we live in, and people, you know, really don't have an appreciation until they hear some of these numbers about how global our food and medical product supplies, in fact, are. And then you see some front page headlines about scary problems like the melamine in dairy products or the heparin or other events. You know, people have, you know, really started to get it. So I would say I was not initially getting the level of support that I had hoped, but it's been growing, and I really can't complain, especially in these times of economic constraint, to be getting some budget increases in this critical area. But I think it's really important for people to understand that the level of demand and what needs to be done versus the mm-hmm. resources, human and dollar, still are dramatically out of sync. And, we have charts that show, you know, the number of imports going way up and our dollars and human resources to address them, you know, just barely inching up. And, I think it is important as we think about investments overall to recognize that this is something that puts us all at serious risk. And it's, you know, something where FDA does have a very unique role to play in partnership with other stakeholders, importantly including industry. But it is something that we cannot afford not to take seriously, and we cannot afford not to continue to build mm-hmm. the infrastructure to support these important issues, but that it's also going to require some new thinking. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, one thing that this new FDASIA law, the Food and Drug Safety and Innovation Act that was recently passed, which gave us some important new authorities and also reauthorized user fees from industry to pay for certain kinds of activities. It starts to open up the opportunities for us to really share information and act mm-hmm. on information from other regulators. But that is something that is going to take a little bit of time for both policymakers and the public to get comfortable with, I think, mm-hmm. because it makes complete sense. There's too much work to be done. We have to do it together across nations with an agreed-on set of standards and outcome measures. But if we rely on an inspection done by another country and then there's a problem, everybody's going to say, how could you possibly have let that happen? Sure. So I think, you know, we do have to be realistic about that.
Well, you do seem to face some very difficult trade-offs. In China, you've got 13 Americans and 30 or 40 Chinese experts staffing three big inspection operations, and you're talking about doubling those operations in the next 18 months and probably doubling them again. And the expectations from Congress are that the numbers of inspections are going to go off like this. And it's not just in the human skill base required to carry out those inspections. It's going to be very hard to sort of meet those. And then in terms of training and replenishing your own base of skills here in the pool of inspectors and investigators that you can draw from is not big enough to have a truly global workforce out there in 5 years or 10 years. So how do you go about dealing with that? And on the Chinese side, it would seem to be imply that you need not these much more effective data trust and data sharing arrangements, but also an ability to incentivize their cooperation by building their capacities in some way. And none of those funding lines exists or programs quite yet.
No, well, that's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think for a minute that we're going to be dramatically expanding the size of our offices, even in a place as important as China, where we have our largest group, as you mentioned, and we're in three different cities, Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangzhou. But we simply have to have new models, and those new mm-hmm. models have to build on the notions of partnership, mm-hmm. both with other regulatory authorities and with industry to mm-hmm. raise standards and also share information in new ways. I think that building regulatory capacity, either helping other nations strengthen their capacity or doing it on a regional basis mm-hmm. is also absolutely critical. And we have some exciting projects going now, working with colleagues in the development community, including the World Bank. And also industry has mm-hmm. been a very eager mm-hmm. and willing partner in some of these, because if we can help to raise the level of capacity in these countries or regions, then we have less work to do because we can have much more confidence that these products, in fact, are being grown or manufactured to standards that are, you know, roughly equivalent to ours. We don't expect that everybody's goal is going to be to be mini FDAs. You know, I would have to say, despite the fact that we often are criticized in the press and on the Hill and in other places, we are and remain the gold standard for a science-based regulatory agency mm-hmm. with a public health mission around the world. And we are, even though we are not adequately resourced in terms of what we need to do, we are also, you know, much more robust than regulatory agencies in most other countries around the world. So I don't expect or think it would even be a wise investment for many countries to try to set a goal of looking like us. But I think that what we do want to do is in critical areas, identify what's the sort of minimum threshold of capacity? What are the activities and capabilities that really are vital to support the regulatory oversight for safety of key industries in a given country, in a given region? And if we, the U.S., working with other more sophisticated and well-endowed regulatory authorities and with industry and other stakeholders can help to shape programs to build this capacity, I think it's a win-win-win for everyone.
Mm-hmm. I read the Institute of Medicine study, and I know there's some folks, Tom Boyke and others here today, who were part of that. And that study was trying to enumerate, trying to provide some estimate of how much capacity. What do we mean by capacity?
Right.
But how much capacity is out there among partners or prospective partners? And the short answer was not a lot, and there are huge gaps as we project forward. And then the question of if we are to begin to try to create new capacity, what should the base priorities be? How do we focus our efforts looking forward?
Right.
And it struck me that this was a moment that very similar to a transformation in CDC 10 years ago when CDC got pulled because of HIV/AIDS epidemic and response and PEPFAR from being an overwhelmingly domestic in its orientation to suddenly having programs and having to think about building capacities.
Right.
10 years later is a much different organization than it was then.
Right.
And that as you are pondering this, you're going to become a development agency, not only a global regulatory public health agency, but one that is deliberately out to try to create capacity.
We are, but we have to do it in partnership. We, you know, we are not a development agency, and we don't have the resources to do the job that needs to be done. But it is a critical need, and it's a need that extends, you know, beyond what our mission is at FDA. You know, our goal is to promote public health and safety through a range of different activities. We believe that our mission dovetails beautifully with the mission of development agencies as well as other stakeholders. If you think about it from a development point of view, investing to build regulatory capacity helps to do a number of critical things. It helps support economic development because you're helping to create stable, more reliable industries, whether it's, you know, local farmers or generic drug manufacturers, but a range of, you know, really important economic institutions for a given country. You're also, by providing this support for regulatory capacity, improving the health and well-being of citizens within those countries. You're also ensuring that development dollars that are going into supporting health programs, you know, whether it's malaria programs or the PEPFAR program for HIV/AIDS, you're also helping to ensure that the products that are purchased, the drugs for treatment and the devices that support care, are in fact high quality and will work. We're seeing a huge problem, for example, in malaria. You mentioned this upcoming event where, you know, sadly a lot of the medications being used for treatment of malaria are substandard. And they're not only not treating and curing malaria, but they're all adding to the growing problem of drug resistance because they don't have the right levels of active pharmaceutical ingredient. So on many levels, your investment in regulatory capacity is fulfilling health needs, economic development needs, in some cases, political stability in countries by addressing those issues. And it's in our own vested interest to have these capacities built up because it means that those products that are coming from outside our borders will be of higher quality.
So you have field operations in 6 countries now, or is it more than that?
Let's see. It's more than that. We have, I think it's 13.
13.
Yeah.
And how has this changed the outlook internally within FDA? I mean, this is a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal. I think, you know, one of the challenges is how do we really integrate what we're doing internationally with what we're doing domestically. And in some areas, it's more obvious and easier than others. But anyone who's working at the FDA, whether it's working on the science or working on the inspection and compliance side, feels the tug, the pressures of globalization. So I think it does make sense. I think everybody is worried about dramatically expanding the mandate when we don't have the time and money to do a smaller set of things. Suddenly, you know, we're working on an international scale, but the circumstances simply demand it. We have done some reorganization within the FDA to address this. We had an international office that was almost, you know, like a boutique office in the office of the commissioner, where all of the functions were sort of coordinated through, and it worked well in the beginning, especially as we were undertaking this huge task of standing up these new offices. But at the end of the day, if we're really going to have a meaningful and sustainable global approach, it has to be much more integrated into the programs themselves. And so we have done some reorganization, and the international office is now part and parcel of what we're calling a directorate that is global operations and regulatory programs and policy. And that enables us to have a sort of a systematic approach across domestic and international inspection and regulatory compliance activities. And then on the medical product side and in other key areas, including tobacco, which is very much an international problem, of course, you know, trying to build the direct relationships between the scientific community within FDA and within the U.S. and within these other countries as we're building up the regulatory science that underlies, you know, sound product development and review. So it is definitely shaking up our culture, and I wouldn't say that it has been, you know, all embraced without question, but I think people understand why it's so important and are enthusiastic about moving towards a new paradigm that will actually enable us to fulfill our mission more effectively.
Where are you seeing the greatest progress overseas in your operations, do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, there are two levels of that. One is that the global community of regulators is really starting to come together, and we're all struggling with similar issues, and, you know, really recognizing that we badly need each other. Mm-hmm. We need each other, you know, just to sort of support us in these, you know, hard times and hard jobs, but also to share information and, as I said, sort of start to divide up some of the workload. Also, with advances in science, as well as the pressures of globalization, the ability to work together to solve problems and sort of decide what's the best approach, how do we really balance these risks and benefits, how do we deal with this whole new emerging technology, and you know, lots of hard questions where by working together and bringing the best minds together wherever they're found is very, very beneficial as well. So this sort of coming together on a more international basis is, I think, you know, very, very important and something that I think we're making real headway on. I was going to make another point, but now I've already forgotten what it was.
Well, when you're talking about a coalition, there's a question of what kind of mechanism would bring you together? People have talked about the G20 as a possibility. There are other fora.
Yeah. Well, I would certainly love to see some of these issues more prominent in some of those important international groups and agenda-setting activities like the G20 and the G8, and we're sort of slowly inserting language and, mm-hmm. and perspective, and I think that will grow. But I think we're also really striving to figure out what kinds of global governance models exist that we could use to inform our thinking about how best to work together as a community of regulators. Would we want to try to, you know, create a forum that's de novo for this purpose? Do we want to work through WHO that already is an international health organization but that hasn't been, mm-hmm. you know, particularly focused, deals with some aspects of this, mm-hmm. but it hasn't been the sort of natural home for a lot of this activity? Do we want to continue to work as we have been working by sort of layering on multilateral and bilateral and international agreements, or do we need something that's more coherent? Of course, one of the challenges is that every regulatory agency looks different. I, at the beginning, talked about the range of products that we're responsible for. Well, that's a very different portfolio than other regulatory agencies have. Mm-hmm. And there are very few that are as comprehensive as the US FDA. Some are only drugs, you know, some are only food, some have a little of this, a little of that. So also figuring out how you deal with a landscape where everybody's a little bit different, but you want to try to create some cross-cutting mm-hmm. themes and organizational foundations. So it's an interesting time, and I think we are making some real progress.
Thank you. Before we open up for the floor, could you just speak for a few minutes about what you think the three or four top priorities in this area should be looking forward to the next administration, next Congress?
Well, I think I have, you know, touched on some of them. I guess I can't begin a discussion like this without saying that no matter how challenging the economic times, this is an arena that we have to continue to invest in and, in fact, strengthen and extend mm-hmm. because it is so fundamentally important to health and quality of life and our economic mm-hmm. future. You know, secondly, I think we do need to be engaged in broader partnerships, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, bringing in the development community and recognizing mm-hmm. that building regulatory capacity at a minimum has to be integrated into work that's being done to build health systems. But I think it goes so much beyond that because it's a fundamental part mm-hmm. of economic development mm-hmm. as well. And it is, at the end of the day, also a security issue. These complex supply chains create real vulnerabilities, and we've seen those vulnerabilities exploited, sadly, because of economic adulteration, people that are putting profits above public health with things like the melamine and the mm-hmm. contaminated heparin. We also know that these vulnerabilities, you know, put us at risk in terms of deliberate acts intended to do harm mm-hmm. for other reasons, including, of course, biological terrorism, potential threats to the food supply, or critical medical products as well. So, you know, I do think we have to elevate this discussion, and we have to think more broadly about where this fits in to our both national and mm-hmm. international needs and investments. And I think that as we go forward, we really have to find these new governance models, mm-hmm. and maybe CSIS can help us think that through. And there are, I think, interesting models out there, and we have to, you know, really figure out a way to institutionalize mm-hmm. some of this, because there's a lot of momentum now, but some of that may be a product of people that are in, important leadership roles. That changes over time, but we want to make sure that as we move forward, that we really have institutional systems that support a new vision for frankly, global public health, safety, and national security.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Why don't we open for comments and questions? What we'll do is we'll bundle things together. We'll take three or four at a time. Why don't we start over on this side, and then I'll return to, we'll have a second or third round. Please identify yourself and be brief. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is James Hill. I'm an advisor in external relations and partnerships at the Pan-American Health Organization. And we've been working with Lou Valdez and Kate Bond, the FDA, on building an information hub in Latin America and Caribbean so the national regulatory authorities can share information. And we're signing confidential agreements so joint inspection reports can be shared. I really praise the forward-thinking FDA in building capacity, because that's really what the Pan-American Health Organization, WHO, have been trying to do. The question I wanted to ask was this. I'm not a technical person, but it seems to be that in terms of drugs and vaccines, that seems to be pretty sophisticated. But in terms of the medical technologies, that seems to present quite a challenge, and would love to hear you comment more on that. Thank you very much.
Can you hold just a minute? Okay.
We have a couple of other hands up here. Let's take the three other folks. Yes.
I'm Rich Koslerich from George Mason University's Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center. You've described very eloquently what FDA is doing, particularly focused on the supply chain. Some research that we've been doing relating to counterfeit pharmaceuticals coming from South Asia in particular has focused on the connection between organized crime and this activity, and particularly outside the traditional supply chain relationship into the financing of these things, particularly over the internet. We're finding that banks in places like Azerbaijan are very directly involved in this. How do you, in creating the kinds of partnerships you've talked about, both domestically and internationally, work in, if you will, the non-traditional regulatory activities? Because it seems to me if you just have your counterparts getting together and talking about this, and not addressing these outside networks, particularly on the financing side, you're only dealing with part of the problem.
In the back row, and then take two more, and then we'll come back to Peggy.
Caroline Smith DeWall, Center for Science and the Public Interest. Commissioner, it's very good to see you. I've always admired your vision in terms of looking beyond our own national shores to controlling safety. We are very concerned, though, at the delays in implementation of very important provisions of the Food Safety Modernization Act, many of which deal with improving the safety of imported food. Today, for example, a simple ministerial function of registering foreign and domestic food facilities, the agency has not released basic guidance to the industry on how to do this. How soon after the election can we expect these very important regulations that President Obama signed into law to be released from the administration?
And then let's take a fourth over here, then we'll come back to you. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christine Malati. I'm a pharmacist that works on quality assurance for PEPFAR at USAID. And so I wanted to congratulate the FDA for the 150th tentative approved drug for HIV. Was wondering if there was going to be a similar approach for other infectious diseases such as malaria or hepatitis C. And my second question was, how can USAID and the FDA work together to build drug regulatory authorities in other countries?
All right. I thought you were going to package them into a couple of simple questions. Well, let's see. I think that a number of really important things have been raised here. I guess, Carolyn, I'll answer your question first, because it's so important, and it is, you know, a real concern about moving forward. There was an important piece of legislation passed a year and a half ago, the Food Safety Modernization Act, which really was a call to transform our food safety system into one that reflects the realities of the modern world, with globalization as a piece of that, and also the recognition that we really need a system that's focused on prevention, not on responding to problems after they happen and scrambling as fast as we can to identify the cause and address it, but to really make sure that the systems are in place to identify where the vulnerabilities are and shore them up before a problem occurs. And that legislation requires putting in place a lot of new activities, working with counterparts at the state and local level as well as internationally, and of course working with industry to really put in place these preventive controls. And you know, a couple of disappointments in how that has unfolded. One is that it did not come with any additional dollars. We've had some small plus ups in terms of our budget. I hope that over time industry will help to support this important program along with larger investments in terms of public dollars, because this is such an important and shared public good. But implementing that broadly expansive mandate with limited resources has been a challenge. We also need to put forward a set of important regulations that we've been developing and are currently in review, and we hope to get those out very soon. And I hope on the registration issue that guidance will be going forward very soon. But it has been frustrating, and I share your concerns. And I think that this administration made it very clear that the status quo was not acceptable as it came to food safety. President Obama came into office in the midst of one of the largest food safety events in recent times. Some of you may remember the contaminated peanut butter from Peanut Corporation of America. I think it had a powerful impact on him as he took on all these new responsibilities to understand you know, how vulnerable the food supply can be and how much it matters to people and their health. So I share your concerns, and we are moving forward, but it has been harder and slower than any of us would have wanted. With respect to the question about, first, PAHO is an example of what we're doing with the Pan American Health Organization. We've actually given resources to this project that you described that really creates a regional information sharing capability and is enhancing the ability of each of the countries involved to do a better job with their regulatory responsibilities and you know, both technical assistance and capacity building is sort of embedded in that. It's a very exciting project, and I think a signal of the kind of thing that can be done with reasonable resources that builds regional capacity and benefits us all. You mentioned the question of emerging technologies in the sense of some of the new mobile applications, I think was what you were referring to, I'm not sure. But you know, the world of medical products is changing dramatically, both because we're deepening our understanding of science in certain arenas, but also because we're applying new technologies to healthcare tasks. And there's a whole realm of new technologies that are associated with information technology and mobile applications and other things that is an area that's, you know, frankly new for us at the FDA and new for other regulators in terms of what's the appropriate level of oversight, how can we support safe and effective, meaningful new technologies and applications without, you know, absolutely being a hindrance to innovation by being overly cumbersome, but assuring some level of effectiveness and real benefit to patients and consumers as well. So that's, I earlier mentioned, you know, that there are areas where there are real benefits working together, bringing the best and the brightest minds to work on hard problems wherever those people are, and that's one area where the technologies really are challenging our old models and often our existing legal and regulatory authorities, because some of these are we're seeing combination products where there's new devices to deliver drugs in new ways, like nanotechnologies that deliver drugs. There are these mobile apps that enable you to, you know, monitor your glucose and calculate your appropriate insulin therapies without, you know, having to do some of the more traditional things. And you want that software, you want those technologies to be accurate because people are making important medical decisions based on them. Range of these kinds of issues that are very, very challenging, and where, again, we need to take a risk-based approach to focus on the things that make the most difference in people's lives. The link between security of the supply chain and the potential for criminal or terrorist engagement is obviously hugely important and an enormous and growing concern. And the problem of counterfeit drugs is one that I think we need to take very, very seriously and requires an international approach with the partnership of regulatory agencies like the FDA, but also, of course, law enforcement and the healthcare community and others. Counterfeits are a real and growing concern. We don't fully understand the nature and scope of the problem. We need to collect better data, but when we do, we know that the problem is profound. I mentioned earlier malaria drugs. You know, there have been some studies in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, and in parts of Asia that show that, you know, stunningly large percentages of the drugs available in the marketplace for malaria and other important medical conditions are substandard or counterfeit or adulterated in some way that damages their ability to be effective and can pose additional risk. So that's intrinsically a problem. And we're seeing episodes involving counterfeits and cargo theft and other things that put products at risk in this country as well. The internet opens up the world in enormous and very frightening ways. We actually launched a new campaign on Friday called Be Safe RX, which is designed to educate consumers about how to recognize legitimate online pharmacies, because that is a real problem, and people think that they are buying drugs in a way that can be cheaper and more convenient by going online, but in fact they're going to pharmacies that may be selling them anything from anywhere, regardless of what their website claims. And there was a study that was done by the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy that looked at 10,000 online pharmacies and found that actually only 3% of them, roughly, were in compliance with state and federal laws. So that's enormously worrisome. So this was a campaign to try to inform consumers because they can be a very important partner in the effort to reduce the threat of counterfeits entering into the system. But on top of that, we have to be working hard with our oversight and inspectional and enforcement capabilities and working more broadly with law enforcement. We work with Interpol and other regulatory agencies, for example, in an ongoing way to address the problem of internet pharmacies. And just lastly, the problem of organized crime getting involved is real and enormously concerning. And, you know, in fact, it is an attractive arena to get into if you're in organized crime because the profits can be huge and the penalties are far lower than if you're dealing in illicit drugs. One of the things that was important in this legislation that we've been talking about a little bit, the Fedazia law, was that it began to increase the penalties on counterfeiting and to make more explicit also our authorities outside the U.S. jurisdiction. But it used to be that actually the penalties for counterfeiting a drug were less than counterfeiting a Gucci bag, which, you know, certainly does not speak to, I think, what our national priorities need to be. But these are all things. You asked me a few moments ago, you know, what are critical areas to work on? I mean, certainly this nexus between public health and security is profound, whether it's food safety or whether it's medical products, and I think it's an area where we can't lose time.
Let me take another round. Tom? Take three or four here.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Commissioner, and congratulations to Steve and CSAS on a great event. What I wanted to ask you, there's a flip side to what you described, and that is as the volume of imports and trade in these products have increased and they've gone to a greater number of countries, regulatory differences between those countries have become more important in terms of facilitating trade. And President Obama has identified, for instance, the regulations that exist around plant and health issues as the biggest barrier to meeting objective of doubling U.S. exports by 2014. And historically, the relationship between trade officials and regulatory officials in dealing with these international challenges haven't been the best. And now I wondered, 4 years in, whether or not what you see as the avenue forward for that model. Are there potential synergies, and what does it look like?
Well, I think there are potential synergies, and we have to find them. But I think there has historically been a tension between trade and public health issues, and that we, as an agency, will always make sure that public health is our driving goal. But I think that we can find more effective ways of marrying public health protection with trade by, you know, really looking at what are the systems and approaches that in fact are the most meaningful with respect to the review and assessment of a product's safety. Sometimes trades get bogged down because different countries do things differently and we can't accept each other's approach. I think we have to step back and sort of look at the outcome. We may do it differently, but, you know, in fact, are we achieving, you know, common goals in terms of the outcome and the safety quality of the product? And so I think, you know, some of those barriers will be able to be eliminated if we can step back and have a thoughtful, science-based look at the issues. Some things are entrenched. Some things are sort of social, cultural as well. But I think we need to work more with the trade community. We need to consult people like you and bring you into our thinking, as we have tried to do as well, to educate ourselves more. And we need a full place at the table. What often happens is that we're not brought in to the last minute, and then we raise issues and we appear to be obstructionist. Well, you know, we're trying to do our job, which is to promote and protect public health, but it'd be much more useful if we could have been brought in early and really be seen as a partner in discussions rather than just a bureaucratic agency that has to sign off before, you know, full clearance can be achieved. So I think some of it is you know, again, it's sort of stepping back and thinking through new models, and some of it is, you know, really fuller engagement. But, you know, some of what we're trying to do, there are inherent tensions, and, you know, and there's a tension also in what we're trying to do to promote stronger industries in other countries to improve the quality of products being produced, which I think is in our national interest and is a good development strategy. But it's also making other countries more competitive with us in terms of trade around certain products. So I think, you know, life is complicated, and some of those complexities simply exist.
We have a hand here. Down here.
And then over here. Austin Demby, I work with the Department of Health and Human Services, coordinating the PEPFAR program across the department. This is really impressive, Commissioner. I think we've been looking for an opportunity to hear from you around your global efforts. We work in PEPFAR in over 30 countries, and there's been major investments in these countries, you know, testing millions of people, putting millions of people on treatment. I think a major concern we have now is how sustainable this is in the long run. We're making real great efforts to make sure that all of these efforts go to building host country capacity to respond to their own problems. It's a good advantage to the countries. It's a great advantage to us as well. I think right now USAID and CDC are helping these countries around regulatory capacity building. But I think it's not enough to not have the FDA, the premier institution around regulatory capacity, leading this process. How do you see the FDA evolving in this role?
Can you hold for a second here? Let's take a comment down here, down at the end.
Hi, my name is Reshma Ramachandran. I'm a fellow with the American Medical Student Association. I had a question in regards to the globalization efforts that have been happening with the WHO in research and development. In the past couple of years, we've seen a kind of a decline in the rate of research and development of new pharmaceuticals, and that's been an increasing concern in the global community, even with the WHO kind of commissioning an expert working group to give new recommendations on better incentives for research and development outside of the usual, which is strengthening intellectual property rights. And I was wondering what the FDA's involvement with these types of initiatives have been in trying to think of new ways to incentivize research and development, especially after, you know, with PDUFA, with the inclusion of the GAIN Act that allows for 5 years of extra data exclusivity for bacteria antibiotics, which was kind of criticized from some of the advocates in the public health community and the global community in, you know, relying on the traditional strengthening of IPR to incentivize research and development. And I was wondering if the FDA has been at the table, you know, in these with you know, in talks with other countries or other key players in the global community about new incentives.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sir, you had your hand up. Yes. Alicia, right here, please.
Thank you. I'm John Yusuf Yazzi from Johns Hopkins University Center for Bioengineering, Innovation, and Design. I wanted to thank the FDA very much for the close collaboration you have with our university and with other universities. I think we implemented this model of bringing FDA perspectives in very early on in the medical device design process. So as you know, the cost of regulation is a major component of cost and risk associated with new medical technology development. And in the world of global health innovation, we need to develop technologies that are high performance at a very low cost. So and this is a kind of a follow-up to the previous two questions. Could you summarize some of the ways that the FDA can help in lowering those costs and improving or reducing the uncertainty associated with global health innovation, developing medical technologies that are perhaps not at the highest level of performance, but have the maximum impact? Thank you.
Okay. Your question related to a question I failed to answer earlier about PEPFAR and USAID, and you know, I think I had sort of spoken to the issues in our earlier discussion in terms of, you know, really the importance of a new engagement around seeing building regulatory capacity as you know, really a critical component of our investments in development, human development, and economic development programs and building health systems. And PEPFAR is a great example of a program that has made a huge difference. But to be successful over time, it has to be more than just buying drugs to treat an important disease or set of related disease conditions. But it really has to be about enabling countries or regions to be able to provide a certain level of care, and we've been very happy to be part of that through the tentative approval process, which is a mechanism that enables us to basically approve generic drugs that brings quality drugs to people at lower costs. And yes, I think there are opportunities to do it in a broader arena, but again, limited resources. And, you know, we have a core set of responsibilities over which we overlay a lot of other things that are important and matter to us. But again, if we're going to really make this work for the long term in ways that make sense, we can't have a sort of crazy quilt approach. We have to really have a thoughtful, systematic, and institutionalized approach. And I think by building regulatory capacity, we can help countries and regions have some of that ability themselves to do what we are doing now at a distance and with a lot of legal restrictions as well as resource restrictions on what we can do and how we do it. So I think we need to continue to really integrate USAID's work with our work in this area. There are opportunities. We're already engaging with Gates Foundation in terms of philanthropy. I think there's opportunities to extend that. And also entities like the World Bank have proven to be an important partner. And, of course, the World Health Organization and its regional components also. So I think, you know, this is part of the building new models, but also putting in place new ways of doing business. As far as how can FDA and the broader scientific enterprise do a better job really advancing biomedical product innovation, it's obviously, you know, one of the really critical questions of our time. And we know that the current models and approaches aren't adequately working. We know that the unmet public health and medical care needs and the costs of care are far outstripping our ability to deliver on what are clearly really exciting and important opportunities in science and technology today, that the pipelines are not robust in critical areas, and that it takes, frankly, too long and too much money to develop drugs. The problem is very complicated, and it involves a complex ecosystem of issues and players. And I do think that this is a critical time to really look at that ecosystem and identify what are some of the critical barriers in each of those domains of activity that need to be addressed. And I think that work is underway and there's a lot more to be done, but that we're not going to be successful either in terms of our national strategy or internationally if we don't really do that. We need to look at IP and patent policy, and there is a role for that in terms of incentivizing industry to participate, but we also recognize that it can be a barrier. So we need to figure out what are the right incentives to make systems work. We have to think about broader economic policies. I mean, critically, access to capital to take a good idea and really move it through the system, and getting public dollars to work with private dollars, and in what is the right set of economic policies to drive biomedical product innovation. We have to look at how we're investing in science, and I personally believe that we are not balanced at the moment. We want to have very strong investments in building out the fundamental science, the discovery science that gives us, you know, the new ideas and the new opportunities and deepens our understanding of disease, because at the end of the day, we're going to be able to advance biomedical product innovation most successfully if we're actually addressing the meaningful targets and understand what is needed to address a disease condition. But we also have to make sure we're investing in what I call regulatory science in a targeted way, which involves this understanding what's necessary for drug development and also developing tools for regulatory review, whether it's biomarkers for predictive toxicology or surrogate endpoints to make clinical trials shorter. Or genetic understanding genetic markers, genetic traits to target our clinical trial designs and ultimately our therapies more effectively, or using information technology for data mining, either for post-market surveillance of safety and efficacy issues or gleaning new information about a product's potential effectiveness from existing databases once you know more about potential subpopulations of responders, et cetera. So there's a lot that we can still develop in terms of new science and application of that new science, but we have to make, you know, better investments in science. And then reimbursement policies make a huge difference in the whole ecosystem around product development and engagement of the private sector with the public sector in key areas. So I think, you know, this is a critical time to really, I keep talking about, you know, sitting around the table with different stakeholders, but it really matters. We have to look at this whole ecosystem, and we have to identify what are some critical barriers in these different domains if we're going to make progress. Was there another question that was left unanswered?
Well, I think we have a couple of other folks who've been persistent and would like to raise a question. So why don't we do three quick last questions right here. We'll start here, and then sir, and over here.
And then. You guys have done such a great job in organizing this forum and addressing the issues, Dr. Hamburg. It's wonderful. I'm Ann Rose. I'm the CEO president of a group called Vicro, which specializes in drug development work, specifically working with the smaller pharma, biotech, medical device groups in helping them get through the drug development and approval process. The gold standard is there, and it is present, and for probably very good reasons. And we were approached recently by Egypt with a group that's working with the Ministry of Health, an offshoot of the Ministry of Health, to come and offer them courses in good clinical practice and GCMPs, et cetera, just because of the globalization and the internationalization and them wanting to be able to make those products, which, and I hope I will reach out to your directorate at FDA as well as CSIS to see if there is some partnership that we can give them a good program. We'll do the heavy lifting, but I just think it's important to have that. My question, though, with risk assessment to you specifically, is what has the administration done, and it's not easy, but with tort reform? Because that is an issue that is really impacting costs, impacting development, impacting what you're doing at FDA, which
Thank
is a
you.
Fabulous job.
Thank you. And let's get two quick last comments, and then we'll come back and close.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hamburg. My name is Steve Guo. I'm with TechCross. It is clear that what you've been doing and you will continue to do will benefit all other countries, including Taiwan, which I come from. And so I sort of, especially, we are importing a lot of goods from the mainland China, not only China. And so I just wonder, are you thinking about ways or approach that all these beneficiary countries can do something to contribute, to share some of the resources or responsibilities down the road? Certainly, I'm not suggesting right away that Taiwan send experts to work with you in Beijing or Shanghai, which is probably politically impossible right now. But other things may be doable. So all this country won't be, again, as free riders. And certainly, there's a great deal of interest to work with the U.S. on these things. And so that's my question. Thank you.
Yes, one last comment right here. Thank you.
Hi, David Fidler from Indiana University. As I hear the description of the FDA's global policy, this sounds so familiar to me from other aspects of public health going global, partnerships, information sharing, use of information technology, this sort of sense of an underlying harmony of interests amongst the actors, private and as well as governmental. I don't want to call any of that low-hanging fruit because it's difficult, but we know from the trajectory of other areas of public health that have gone into globalization that interests begin to diverge in a major way, which creates roadblocks, whether that's with trade, as Tom mentioned, or political priorities change, or there's even diplomatic fragmentation within governments as people try to push these different agendas. I was just wondering, as you look forward, and I know you understand these other problems from these other areas of public health going global, are there one or two of these areas that you're really worried about, and what strategies is FDA thinking about to try to mitigate or flank what we know is coming from the development of these other global areas of public health?
Okay, well, let me try to be relatively quick. I can be very quick on tort reform because that just isn't my area of expertise, and I wouldn't want to speak to what has been done because I just wouldn't be able to give you an accurate portrayal. But you know what I can speak to is that we do need to think about risks and benefits from the FDA perspective in some new ways, and we need to really balance what society and patients are willing to accept as risks with, you know, the overall benefit to populations. It's a hard challenge, and we're trying to do it better, and we're trying to do it more explicitly so that companies that are thinking about making investments can better understand it as they weigh their risks and benefits in making an investment and a commitment to a product development. And we're also trying to be more explicit and provide better information to patients and consumers and healthcare providers as you know, they make decisions on a much more personal level. And obviously, how we deal with risks and benefits fits into your broader question on the legal and liability context. And, you know, sadly, people want to accept more risk until there's a problem, and then they say, why did you let me take this risk? But, you know, it's an ongoing, you know, I think, societal conversation that's challenging but really, really important, and certainly does engage the FDA in important ways. And we are very proactively and formally engaging in those kinds of discussions, partly because of what's in this new legislation that empowers us to really take on that question in a new way. The question was asked about sort of what can other countries do, and that relates to something else that came up. I mean, I think we need to figure out. Oh, you mentioned good clinical practice. That's an area that we're asked all the time by countries around the world. You know, can you come? Can you provide technical assistance? Well, one way that countries can work together, and countries of different levels of regulatory capacity, but with certain areas of expertise, we need to create some shared approaches, some training programs, develop curriculum. We need to find ways. I mean, we cannot keep going around the world, you know, providing technical expertise to everybody that asks, but we can provide input to something that could have much more broad benefit. And some of it, you know, is just, you know, so fundamental. I mean, I said, why do we keep sending people to different countries to do this training program? Why don't we put it on tape and, you know, do it that way, or do train the train or whatever? But I think there are clearly areas, and GCP is one, where we could formalize, you know, some of this, because there are some clear standards and approaches that, you know, we would want any country that was engaging in supporting clinical trials research to be doing. So I think that's a broad bucket area. David, your question, and I think we've had the opportunity to talk about global governance around various issues, and it's probably no surprise that I come to FDA and I'm thinking about global governance there too. But it is really, really important, and yes, there are going to be bumps along the road for sure, and the issues of you know, national sovereignty versus shared responsibility are always important and are going to remain. But I do think that there is a coming together that enables us to do something that will matter. We probably won't get all the way to where I would want to be, but I think we do really need to formalize some new ways of relating across national regulatory authorities. And in some key areas, there are dramatic shifts in willingness to engage in these discussions. You know, if someone earlier raised the counterfeit drug issue. Well, a lot of counterfeit activities for a long time have been bogged down by issues of IP and some countries not wanting to participate because they think that anti-counterfeiting programs is really subtext for limiting opportunities for generic drug development in their country or whatever. But I think because everybody is experiencing problems, if you're getting supply chains from other countries, you're now faced with the problem of concerns about the integrity of those supply chains and of the products that you're getting and the active pharmaceuticals, that ingredients that you're getting, et cetera. And so we're really seeing in some ways, I mean, a couple years ago, the discussions around at the World Health Assembly around the programs to address counterfeit drugs, you know, just broke down. They has been a coming back together, really with public health being the centerpiece of the discussion and focusing not on counterfeits as it relates to intellectual property, but counterfeits and substandard products as it relates to impact on public health. And I think, you know, with that revised frame, we can do a lot more. So I think, you know, we're going to do this in a stepwise way, and we're going to come across problems. And I'd mentioned earlier that at the end of the day, I think we're always gonna have an uncomfortable situation where we see a need to depend more and more on information that may be collected by other regulatory authorities or reported to us by others. But when we take actions based on that information and something goes wrong, there's going to be a price to pay. So I think that there's going to be a pendulum that's going to go back and forth as we move towards systems that hopefully will work in a more enduring way. But we welcome input from people like you that have thought about these issues from other perspectives. And we're looking at all kinds of different models that are out there that we might be able to take pieces from to sort of figure out how to make this work. Because it will, at the end of the day, be a patchwork of national and more international approaches.
Thank you. We've reached the end of our time, and this has been exceptionally rich. We're very grateful to you for being with us for this period. Your question around whether we can be of help as you deliberate further on governance and models, we'd be more than happy to be part of that, and we can follow up. So please join me in thanking Dr. Hamburg. Thank you.